and many of the world's greatest scientific minds. After revolutionary discoveries in particle physics, chemistry, and metallurgy, after the construction of laboratories and reactors and processing facilities, employing tens of thousands of workers, and all of that accomplished within 3 years, the most important part of the most expensive weapon ever built was going to be put together in the master bedroom of a little adobe ranch house. The core of the first nuclear device would be not only homemade, but handmade. The day before, Sergeant Lair had sealed the windows with plastic sheets and masking tape to keep out the dust. Although the question of how to control an atomic bomb had inspired a good deal of thought, a different issue now seemed more urgent. Would the thing work? Before leaving Los Alamos, 200 miles to the north, some of the Manhattan Project's physicists had placed bets on the outcome of the upcoming test, codenamed Trinity. Norman F. Ramsey bet the device would be a dud. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the project's scientific director, predicted a yield equal to 300 tons of TNT. Edward Teller thought the yield would be closer to 45,000 tons. In the early days of the project, Teller was concerned that the intense heat of a nuclear explosion would set fire to the atmosphere and kill every living thing on Earth. A year's worth of calculations suggested that was unlikely, and the physicist Hans Bethe dismissed the idea, arguing that heat from the explosion would rapidly dissipate in the air, not ignite it. But nobody could be sure. During the drive down from Los Alamos on Friday the 13th, Enrico Fermi, who'd already won a Nobel for his discoveries in physics, suggested that the odds of the atmosphere's catching fire were about 1 in 10. Victor Weisskopf couldn't tell if Fermi was joking. Weisskopf had done some of the calculations with Teller and still worried about the risk. As Lewis Slotin prepared to assemble the plutonium core, the safety precautions were as rudimentary as the workspace. Jeeps waited outside the house with their engines running in case everyone had to get out of there fast. Slotin was a Canadian physicist in his early 30s. For the past 2 years at Los Alamos, he'd performed some of the most dangerous work, criticality experiments in which radioactive materials were brought to the verge of a chain reaction. The experiments were nicknamed Tickling the Dragon's Tail, and a small mistake could produce a lethal dose of radioactivity. At the ranch house, Slotin placed a neutron initiator, which was about the size of a golf ball, into one of the plutonium hemispheres, attached it with scotch tape, put the other hemisphere on top, and sealed a hole with a plutonium plug. The assembled core was about the size of a tennis ball, but weighed as much as a bowling ball. Before handing it to Brigadier General Thomas F. Farrell, Slotin asked for a receipt. The Manhattan Project was an unusual mix of civilian and military personnel, and this was the nation's first official transfer of nuclear custody. The general decided that if he had to sign for it, he should get a chance to hold it. "So I took this heavy ball in my hand, and I felt it growing warm," Farrell recalled. "I got a sense of its hidden power." The idea of an atomic bomb, like so many other technological innovations, had first been proposed by the science fiction writer H.G. Wells. In his 1914 novel, The World Set Free, Wells describes the ultimate explosive, fueled by radioactivity. It enables a single person to carry about in a handbag an amount of latent energy sufficient to wreck half a city. These atomic bombs threaten the survival of mankind, as every nation seeks to obtain them and use them before being attacked. Millions die, the world's great capitals are destroyed, and civilization nears collapse. But the novel ends on an optimistic note, as fear of a nuclear apocalypse leads to the establishment of world government. The catastrophe of the atomic bombs, which shook men out of cities, shook them also out of their old established habits of thought, Wells wrote, full of hope, on the eve of the First World War. The atomic bombs in the world set free detonated slowly, spewing radioactivity for years. During the 1930s, the Hungarian physicist Leo Szilard, who'd met with H.G. Wells in 1929 and tried without success to obtain the Central European literary rights to his novels, conceived of a nuclear weapon that would explode instantly. A Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany, Szilard feared that Hitler might launch an atomic bomb program and get the weapon first. Szilard discussed his concerns with Albert Einstein in the summer of 1939 and helped draft a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The letter warned that it may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium, leading to the creation of extremely powerful bombs of a new type. Einstein signed the letter, which was hand-delivered to the president by a mutual friend. After British researchers concluded that such weapons could indeed be made, and intelligence reports suggested that German physicists were trying to make them, the Manhattan Project was formed in 1942. Led by Leslie R. Groves, a brigadier general in the U.S. Army, it secretly gathered eminent scientists from Canada, Great Britain, and the United States with the aim of creating atomic bombs. Conventional explosives like TNT detonate through a chemical reaction. They are unstable substances that can be quickly converted into gases of a much larger volume. The process by which they detonate is similar to the burning of a log in a fireplace. Except that unlike the burning of a log, which is slow and steady, the combustion of an explosive is almost instantaneous. At the point of detonation, temperatures reach as high as 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit. As hot gases expand into the surrounding atmosphere, they create a shockwave of compressed air, also known as a blast wave, that can carry tremendous destructive force. The air pressure at sea level is 14.7 pounds per square inch. A conventional explosion can produce a blast wave with an air pressure of 1.4 million pounds per square inch. Although the thermal effects of that explosion may cause burns and set fires, it's the blast wave, radiating from the point of detonation like a solid wall of compressed air, that can knock down a building. The appeal of a nuclear explosion for the Manhattan Project scientists was the possibility of an even greater destructive force. A plutonium core the size of a tennis ball had the potential to raise the temperature at the point of detonation to tens of millions degrees Fahrenheit and increase the air pressure to many millions of pounds per square inch. Creating that sort of explosion, however, was no simple task. The difference between a chemical reaction and a nuclear reaction is that in the latter, atoms aren't simply being rearranged. They're being split apart. The nucleus of an atom contains protons and neutrons tightly bound together. The binding energy inside the nucleus is much stronger than the energy that links one atom to another. When a nucleus splits, it releases some of that binding energy. This splitting is called fission, and some elements are more fissionable than others, depending on their weight. The lightest element, hydrogen, has one proton. The heaviest element found in nature, uranium, has 92. In 1933, Leo Szilard realized that bombarding certain heavy elements with neutrons could not only cause them to fission, but could also start a chain reaction. Neutrons released from one atom would strike the nucleus of a nearby atom, freeing even more neutrons. The process could become self-sustaining. If the energy was released gradually, it could be used as a source of power to run electrical generators. And if the energy was released all at once, it could cause an explosion with temperatures many times hotter than the surface of the sun. Two materials were soon determined to be fissile, that is, capable of sustaining a rapid chain reaction: uranium-235 and plutonium-239. Both were difficult to obtain. Plutonium is a man-made element created by bombarding uranium with neutrons. Uranium-235 exists in nature, but in small amounts. A typical sample of uranium is about 0.07% uranium-235, and to get that fissile material, the Manhattan Project built a processing facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Completed within 2 years, it was the largest building in the world. The plutonium for the Manhattan Project came from 3 reactors in Hanford, Washington. A series of experiments was conducted to discover the ideal sizes, shapes, and densities for a chain reaction. When the mass was too small, the neutrons produced by fission would escape. When the mass was large enough, it would become critical. A chain reaction would start, and the number of neutrons being produced would exceed the number escaping. And when an even larger mass became supercritical, it would explode. That was the assumption guiding the Manhattan Project scientists. In order to control a nuclear weapon, they had to figure out how to make fissile material become supercritical, without being anywhere near it. The first weapon design was a gun-type assembly. 2 pieces of fissile material would be placed at opposite ends of a large gun barrel, and then one would be fired at the other. When the pieces collided, they'd form a supercritical mass. Some of the most difficult computations involved the time frame of these nuclear interactions. A nanosecond is 1/1,000,000th of a second, and the fission of a plutonium atom occurs in 10 nanoseconds. One problem with the gun-type design was its inefficiency. The 2 pieces would collide and start a chain reaction, but they'd detonate before most of the material had a chance to fission. Another problem was that plutonium turned out to be unsuitable for use in such a design. Plutonium emits stray neutrons and, as a result, could start a chain reaction in the gun barrel prematurely, destroying the weapon without creating a large explosion. A second design promised to overcome these problems by increasing the speed at which a piece of plutonium might be made supercritical. The new weapon design was nicknamed at first the Introvert. A sphere of plutonium would be surrounded by conventional explosives. The shock wave from the detonation of these explosives would compress the sphere. And the denser the sphere became, the more efficiently it would trap neutrons. The more neutrons, the more fission, a secret government manual on nuclear weapons later explained. We care about neutrons. Imploding a ball of plutonium to produce an explosion was a brilliant idea, but it was easier said than done. If the conventional explosives failed to produce a shockwave that was perfectly symmetrical, the plutonium wouldn't implode. It would blow to pieces. Many of the physicists who worked on the Manhattan Project, Oppenheimer, Fermi, Teller, Bethe, later became well known. And yet one of the crucial design characteristics of almost every nuclear weapon built since then was perfected by George Kiszczakowski, a tall, elegant chemist. Born in the Ukraine and raised in an academic family, Kiszczakowski had fought against the Bolsheviks during the Russian Civil War. He later earned a degree at the University of Berlin, emigrated to the United States, and became a professor of chemistry, first at Princeton, then at Harvard. By the mid-1940s, he was America's leading expert on explosives. Creating a perfectly symmetrical shockwave required not just the right combination of explosives, but also the right sizes and shapes. Kiszczakowski and his team at Los Alamos molded explosive charges into 3-dimensional lenses, hoping to focus the shockwave like the lens of a camera focuses light. Tons of explosives were routinely detonated in the hillsides of Los Alamos as different lens configurations were tested. Kiszczakowski considered these lenses to be precision devices, not crude explosives. Each weighed between 70 and 100 pounds. As the date of the Trinity test approached, he spent long hours at the lab with a dentist's drill, eliminating the air bubbles in lenses and filling the holes with molten explosives. The slightest imperfection could distort the path of a shockwave. The final design was a sphere composed of 32 shaped charges, 12 pentagons, and 20 hexagons. It looked like a gigantic soccer ball and weighed about 5,000 pounds. The shape and composition of the explosive lenses were irrelevant, however, if the lenses failed to detonate at exactly the same time. The shockwave would travel through the device at a speed of 1 millimeter per millionth of a second. If a single lens detonated a few 10 millionths of a second before the others, it could shatter the plutonium without starting a chain reaction. Blasting caps and primacord were the detonators usually employed with conventional explosives, but both proved incapable of setting off 32 charges simultaneously. The physicist Luis Alvarez and his assistant Lawrence Johnston invented a new type of detonator for the job, the exploding bridge wire detonator. It sent a high voltage current through a thin silver wire inserted into an explosive. The current vaporized the wire, creating a small shockwave, and detonated the explosive. Donald F. Hornig, who was one of the youngest scientists at Los Alamos, devised a contraption, the X-Unit, that could store 5,600 volts in a bank of capacitors and then send that electricity instantaneously to all the detonators. In theory, the X-Unit and the exploding bridge wires would set off 32 explosive lenses at once, creating the perfect shockwave and imploding the plutonium core. In reality, these new inventions were unpredictable. Cracked insulation frequently caused the detonators to short-circuit. When that happened, they didn't work. And a week before the Trinity test, an X-Unit fired prematurely during a lightning storm. It had been triggered by static electricity in the air. The misfire suggested that a nuclear weapon could be set off by a lightning bolt. At 3:18 in the afternoon on July 13, 1945, the plutonium core was delivered to a steel tower a couple of miles from the McDonald Ranch House. The tower rose about 100 feet above the desert and resembled an oil rig with a small shed on top. The rest of the nuclear device sat inside a tent at the base of the tower, awaiting completion. At first, the core wouldn't fit inside it. For a few minutes, nobody could understand why, and then the reason became clear. The plutonium was warm, but the housing that it was supposed to enter had been cooled by the shade of the tent. Once the housing warmed, the core easily slid in. At about 4 o'clock, a thunderstorm threatened and the tent started to flap violently in the wind. The small group of scientists left the base of the tower and waited for half an hour at the ranch house until the storm passed. When they returned, Kiszczakowski supervised the placement of the last explosive lenses, and at dusk, the device was bolted shut. The next morning, as it was slowly hoisted to the top of the tower, surplus army mattresses were stacked to a height of 15 feet directly beneath it, in case the cable broke. The nuclear device was an assortment of spheres within spheres. First an outer aluminum casing, then two layers of explosives, then a thin layer of boron and plastic to capture neutrons that might enter from outside the core, then more aluminum, then a tamper of uranium-238 to reflect neutrons that might escape from inside the core, then the ball of plutonium, and finally, at the very center, the golf ball-size neutron initiator, a mixture of beryllium and polonium that would flood the device with neutrons, like a nuclear fuse, when the shockwave from the lenses struck. Inside the metal shed atop the tower, the detonators were installed by hand, two for every explosive lens linked to a pair of X-units. The device now looked like something concocted in a mad scientist's laboratory. A 6-foot-tall aluminum globe with a pair of large boxes, the X-units attached to it, and 32 thick electrical cables leaving each box, winding around the sphere and entering evenly spaced holes on its surface. The Trinity test was scheduled for 4 in the morning on July 16th, but forecasters predicted bad weather. Going ahead with the test could prove disastrous. In addition to the threat of lightning, high winds and rain could carry radioactive fallout as far as Amarillo, Texas, 300 miles away. Postponing the test had other drawbacks. The device could be damaged by the rain, and President Harry S. Truman was in Potsdam, Germany, preparing to meet with Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister, and Joseph Stalin, the General Secretary of the Soviet Union's Communist Party. Nazi Germany had recently been defeated, and Truman was about to demand an unconditional surrender from the Japanese. Having an atomic bomb would make it easier to issue that demand. General Groves argued that the test should go forward as planned, and Oppenheimer agreed. Both men became increasingly nervous on the evening of the 15th, not only about the weather, but also about the risk of sabotage. And so Donald Hornig was instructed to babysit the bomb. At 9 p.m., Hornig climbed to the top of the 100-foot tower as rain began to fall. He brought a collection of humorous essays, Desert Island Decameron. His reading was interrupted by the arrival of a violent electrical storm. Atop the tower, in a flimsy metal shed, Hornig sat alone with the book, the fully armed device, a telephone, and a single light bulb dangling from a wire. He was 25 years old and had recently earned a Ph.D. in chemistry at Harvard. Having designed the X-Unit, he knew better than anyone how easily it could be triggered by static electricity. Whenever he saw a lightning bolt, he'd count the seconds, 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, until he heard the thunder. Some of the lightning felt awfully close. At midnight, the phone rang, and Hornig was told to come down. Hornig did so gladly in the pouring rain. He was the last person to see the device. The test was pushed back to 5:30 in the morning, right before dawn. The rain ended and the weather cleared. The radio frequency used to announce the final countdown was similar to that of a local station. Thanks to interference, at the moment of detonation, Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings cheerfully played in the control bunker. Kiszczakowski stepped out of the bunker to see the fireball and was knocked to the ground by the blast wave. He was about 6 miles from where the tower had just stood. This is what the end of the world will look like, he thought. This is the last thing the last man will see. Viktor Weisskopf saw the flash and felt the heat on his face from a distance of 10 miles. His heart sank. For a moment he thought that his calculations were wrong and the atmosphere was on fire. The hills were bathed in brilliant light, Otto Frisch, a British physicist, observed, as if somebody had turned the sun on with a switch. General Farrell expressed the mixture of fear, awe, pride, and an underlying attraction that this new power inspired. The whole country was lighted by a searing light with the intensity many times that of the midday sun. It was golden, purple, violet, gray, and blue. It lighted every peak, crevasse, and ridge of the nearby mountain range with a clarity and beauty that cannot be described. It was that beauty the great poets dream about, but describe most poorly and inadequately. 30 seconds after, the explosion came first, the air blast pressing hard against the people and things, to be followed almost immediately by the strong, sustained, awesome roar which warned of doomsday and made us feel that we puny things were blasphemous to dare tamper with the forces heretofore reserved to the Almighty. Kenneth Bainbridge, the supervisor of the test, turned to Oppenheimer and said, "Now we are all sons of bitches." Within minutes, the mushroom cloud reached 8 miles into the sky. The atomic bomb was no longer the stuff of science fiction, and the question now was what to do with it. On September 1, 1939, President Franklin D. Roosevelt had issued a statement condemning the inhuman barbarism of aerial attacks on civilian populations. Nazi Germany had invaded Poland that day, and the Second World War had begun. Aerial bombardment promised to make the trench warfare of the previous World War, long a symbol of cruel, pointless slaughter, seem almost civilized and quaint. In April 1937, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, had attacked the Spanish city of Guernica, killing a few hundred civilians. 8 months later, the Japanese had bombed and invaded the Chinese city of Nanking, killing many thousands. An era of total war had dawned, and traditional rules of warfare seemed irrelevant. President Roosevelt appealed to the European powers for restraint. The ruthless bombing from the air of civilians in unfortified centers of population, he said, has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. Roosevelt's appeal for decency and morality had no effect. The city of Warsaw was soon destroyed by German aircraft and artillery. Then London was attacked from the air. The British retaliated by bombing Berlin. New theories of air power were applied on an unprecedented scale. Unlike tactical strikes aimed at an enemy's military forces, strategic bombing focused on transportation systems and factories, the economic infrastructure necessary for waging war. Strategic assets were usually found in the heart of cities. At first, the British refrained from deliberate attacks on German civilians. The policy of the Royal Air Force, RAF, changed, however, in the fall of 1941. The Luftwaffe had attacked the English cathedral town of Coventry, and most of the RAF bombs aimed at Germany's industrial facilities were missing by a wide mark. The RAF's new target would be something more intangible than rail yards or munitions plants: the morale of the German people. Bombarding residential neighborhoods, it was hoped, would diminish the will to fight. "The immediate aim is therefore twofold," an RAF memo explained, "namely to produce, 1, destruction, and 2, the fear of death." The RAF Bomber Command, under the direction of Air Marshal Arthur Bomber Harris, unleashed a series of devastating nighttime raids on German cities. During Operation Gomorrah in July 1943, RAF bombs started a fire in Hamburg with hurricane-force winds. The first firestorm ever ignited by aerial bombardment, it killed about 40,000 civilians. American bombers participated in Operation Gomorrah and the subsequent RAF attack on Dresden, where perhaps 20,000 civilians died. But the United States Army Air Forces, USAAF, opposed the British policy of targeting residential areas, known as de-housing. Instead of the RAF's nighttime area bombing, the strategic doctrine of the USAAF called for daytime precision bombing. Relying on the Norden bomb sight, a device that combined a telescope, a mechanical computer, and an autopilot, the USAAF tried to destroy German factories, ports, military bases, and lines of communication. Precision bombing was rarely precise, and the vast majority of bombs still missed their targets. Nevertheless, American air crews risked their lives conducting raids in broad daylight to avoid killing German civilians. In the Pacific War, a different set of rules applied. The Japanese were considered racially inferior, often depicted as monkeys or vermin in American propaganda. The Japanese had attacked the United States without warning. They had treated Allied prisoners of war with brutality, employed slave labor, and launched suicide attacks instead of surrendering. They had forced as many as 200,000 Korean women to serve as prostitutes in military brothels. They had killed almost 1 million Chinese civilians with chemical and biological weapons. They had killed millions of other civilians in China, Burma, Korea, Singapore, Malaysia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. War crimes driven by the Japanese belief in their own racial superiority. At first, the United States conducted only precision bombing raids on Japan, but heavy cloud cover and high-altitude winds made it difficult to hit industrial targets. On the night of March 9, 1945, the Army Air Forces tried a new approach. American planes struck Tokyo with 2,000 tons of bombs containing napalm and jellied gasoline. Although a major industrial area was destroyed, the real targets were block after block of Japanese buildings made of wood, paper, and bamboo. Within hours, the firestorm consumed one quarter of the city. It killed about 100,000 civilians and left about 1 million homeless. This was truly, in the words of historian John W. Dower, war without mercy. The firebombing of Tokyo wasn't condemned by President Roosevelt. On the contrary, it was soon followed by the firebombing of Nagoya, Osaka, Kobe, Kawasaki, and Yokohama. By the middle of June, the United States had laid waste to Japan's six leading industrial cities. Then American planes launched incendiary attacks on dozens of smaller cities. The level of destruction varied considerably. About one quarter of Osaka was destroyed by fire, one third of Kawasaki, more than half of Kobe. Toyama, a city on the Sea of Japan with chemical plants and a population of about 125,000, was hit the hardest. After a nighttime raid by B-29 bombers, the proportion of Toyama still standing was an estimated 0.5%. As Japanese cities vanished in flames, Leo Szilard began to have doubts about the atomic bomb. He had been the first to push hard for its development in the United States, but he now opposed its use against Japanese civilians. In June 1945, Szilard and a group of scientists at the University of Chicago sent a report to the leadership of the Manhattan Project, asking that the power of nuclear weapons be demonstrated to the world at an appropriately selected uninhabited area. A nuclear attack upon Japan, they contended, would harm the reputation of the United States, make it difficult to secure international control of this new means of indiscriminate destruction, and start a dangerous arms race. But the die had been cast. A committee of presidential advisors had already decided that a public demonstration of an atomic bomb was too risky, because the weapon might not work. That Japan should not be given any warning of a nuclear attack for much the same reason. That the bomb should be aimed at a war plant surrounded by workers' housing, and that the goal of the bombing would be to make a profound psychological impression on as many workers as possible. The ideal target of the atomic bomb would be a large city that had not yet been firebombed, so the effects of the new weapon could be reliably assessed. The first four choices of the president's target committee were Kyoto, Hiroshima, Yokohama, and Kokura. Secretary of War Henry Stimson insisted that Kyoto be removed from the list, arguing that the city had played too central a role in Japanese art, history, and culture to be wiped out. Nagasaki took its place. The day after the Trinity test, Szilard and more than 68 other Manhattan Project scientists signed a petition addressed to the president. It warned that using the atomic bomb against Japan would open the door to an era of devastation on an unimaginable scale and place American cities in continuous danger of sudden annihilation. The petition never reached the president, and even if it had, it probably wouldn't have changed his mind. Franklin Roosevelt had never told his vice president, Harry Truman, about the Manhattan Project or the unusual weapon that it was developing. When Roosevelt died unexpectedly on April 12, 1945, Truman had the thankless task of replacing a beloved and charismatic leader during wartime. The new president was unlikely to reverse a nuclear policy set in motion years earlier, at enormous expense, because a group of relatively unknown scientists now considered it a bad idea. Truman's decision to use the atomic bomb was influenced by many factors, and the desire to save American lives ranked near the top. An invasion of Japan was scheduled for November 1st. Former President Herbert Hoover warned Truman that such an invasion would cost between 500,000 and 1 million American lives. At the War Department, it was widely assumed that American casualties would reach 500,000. During the recent Battle of Okinawa, more than one-third of the American landing force had been killed or wounded, and a full-scale invasion of Japan might require 1.8 million American troops. While meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in June 1945, Truman expressed the hope of avoiding an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other. Unlike most presidents, Truman had first-hand experience of battle. During the First World War, half of the men in his infantry division were killed or wounded during the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. Standing amid piles of dead American soldiers, the sergeant of his platoon had yelled at the survivors, "Now, you'll believe you're in a war." Truman took no pleasure in the deaths of Japanese civilians, but he preferred them to the deaths of young American servicemen. Atomic bombs, he decided, would be dropped on Japan as soon as they were ready. The Trinity test had been preceded by weeks of careful preparation, and every effort had been made to control the outcome. The device had been slowly and patiently assembled. The wiring and explosives had been repeatedly checked. The tower had been built, the location of the test chosen, and each step of the countdown arranged as part of an elaborate scientific experiment. Turning an experimental device into an operable weapon presented a new set of challenges. Atomic bombs had to be dropped somehow, and American air crews had to survive the detonations. B-29 bombers were secretly retrofitted so that nuclear weapons would fit inside them, and pilots were secretly recruited to fly these silverplate B-29s. They practiced dropping dummy bombs, then banking steeply to escape the blast. Enough fissile material for two nuclear weapons, a gun-type device loaded with uranium-235 and an implosion device with a plutonium core, were readied for use against Japan. The arming and fusing mechanisms of the bombs would determine when they exploded, whether they exploded, and how much time the bomber crews would have to get as far away as possible. Both designs relied on the same three-stage fusing system. When a bomb was released at an altitude of about 30,000 feet, arming wires that linked it to the plane would be pulled out, starting a bank of spring-wound mechanical clocks inside the weapon. After 15 seconds, the clocks would close an electrical switch and send power to the firing circuits. At an altitude of 7,000 feet, a set of barometric switches detecting the change in air pressure would close another circuit, turning on four radar units, nicknamed Archies, that pointed at the ground. When the Archies sensed that the bomb was at an altitude of 1,850 feet, another switch would close and the firing signal would be sent. In the gun-type device, that signal would ignite small bags of cordite, a smokeless gunpowder, and shoot one piece of uranium down the barrel at the other. In the implosion device, the firing signal would set off the X units. Both bomb types were rigged to detonate about 1,800 feet above the ground. That was the altitude, according to J. Robert Oppenheimer, appropriate for the maximum demolition of light structures. Had the bombs been aimed at industrial buildings instead of homes, the height of the airburst would have been set lower. The arming and fusing mechanisms were repeatedly tested at a bombing range in Wendover, Utah. At the end of a successful test, the dummy bomb released a puff of smoke. But no amount of practice could eliminate fears that a real atomic bomb might detonate accidentally. Oppenheimer was especially concerned about the risk. "We should like to know whether the takeoff can be arranged," he wrote to a USAAF liaison officer in 1944, "at such a location that the effects of a nuclear explosion would not be disastrous for the base and the squadron." The implosion bomb could be inadvertently set off by a fire, a bullet striking an explosive lens, a small error in assembly. If a B-29 carrying an implosion bomb was forced to return to its base, the President's Target Committee decided that the crew should jettison the weapon into shallow water from a low altitude. The emergency procedure for a gun-type bomb was more problematic. The gun-type bomb was likely to detonate after a crash into the ocean. Water is a neutron moderator, and its presence inside the bomb would start a chain reaction, regardless of whether the two pieces of uranium slammed together. No suitable jettisoning ground has been found, the committee concluded in May 1945, which is sufficiently devoid of moisture, which is sufficiently soft that the projectile is sure not to seep from the impact, and which is sufficiently remote from extremely important American installations whose damage by a nuclear explosion would seriously affect the American war effort. The best advice that the committee could give was hardly reassuring to air crews whose bombing runs traversed the Pacific Ocean for thousands of miles. Try to remove the cordite charges from the bomb mid-air and make sure to crash the plane on land. Captain William S. Parsons was selected to be the bomb commander and weaponeer for the first military use of a nuclear weapon. A naval officer who'd spent years researching bomb fuses, Parsons was chief of the Manhattan Project's Ordnance Division. At Los Alamos, he'd supervised development of the gun-type bomb, which was to be dropped on the city of Hiroshima. Codenamed Little Boy, the bomb was 10 feet long and weighed about 10,000 pounds. It contained almost all the processed uranium in existence, about 141 pounds. The relative inefficiency of the design was offset by its simplicity. Although a gun-type bomb had never been tested, Oppenheimer assured Parsons that the odds of a less-than-optimal performance are quite small and should be ignored. The bomb was assembled in an air-conditioned shed on the island of Tinian, where the silver-plate B-29s of the 509th Composite Group were based. Tinian had the largest, busiest airfield in the world, located 1,300 miles southeast of Tokyo and constructed within months of its capture from the Japanese the previous year. The four main runways were a mile and a half long. At the insistence of General Groves, the Manhattan Project's dedication to secrecy was so rigorous that even the Army Air Force's officer who commanded Tinian was not told about the atomic bomb or the mission of the unusual B-29 stationed there. Worried that a nuclear accident might kill thousands of American servicemen and destroy an airfield crucial to the war effort, Captain Parsons decided, without informing Groves, that the final steps of assembling Little Boy would not be completed until the plane carrying it had flown a safe distance from the island. At 3 a.m. on August 6, 1945, Parsons and another weaponeer, Morris Jepson, left the cockpit and climbed into the bomb bay of a B-29 named Enola Gay, after the pilot's mother. The plane was flying at an altitude of 5,000 feet, about 60 miles off the coast of Tinian. After making sure that three green safing plugs were inserted into the bomb, Parsons unscrewed the back of it while Jepson held a flashlight and air turbulence bounced the plane. Nobody had ever done this procedure to a weapon containing fissile material, let alone to one dangling from a single hook in a darkened bomb bay. The men kneeled on a narrow aluminum platform that had been installed the previous day. It took Parsons about 20 minutes to put four small silk bags of cordite into the breech of the gun barrel, reattach the primer wires, and close the back of the bomb. 4.5 hours later, Jepson returned to the bomb bay alone. The plane was now at about 9,000 feet, nearing the coast of Japan, and the bomb bay felt a lot colder. The green safing plugs blocked the electrical circuit between the fusing system and the cordite. Jepson replaced them with red arming plugs. Little Boy was now fully armed, drawing power from its own batteries and not from the plane. The city of Hiroshima spread across half a dozen islands in the delta of the Ota River. Much of the population had fled to the countryside, leaving about 300,000 people in town. The aiming point for Little Boy was the Aiyui Bridge, far from the industrial plants on the other islands. The bridge lay in the heart of the city, near the headquarters of the Second Army, amid a residential and commercial district. The bomb was dropped from the Enola Gay at about 8:16 a.m., fell for about 44 seconds, and detonated at an altitude of roughly 1,900 feet. At ground zero, directly beneath the airburst, the temperature reached perhaps 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Everyone on the bridge was incinerated, and hundreds of fires were ignited. The blast wave flattened buildings, a firestorm engulfed the city, and a mushroom cloud rose almost 10 miles into the sky. From the plane, Hiroshima looked like a roiling, bubbling sea of black smoke and fire. A small amount of fissile material was responsible for the devastation. 98.62% of the uranium in Little Boy was blown apart before it could become supercritical. Only 1.38% actually fissioned, and most of that uranium was transformed into dozens of lighter elements. About 80,000 people were killed in Hiroshima, and more than two-thirds of the buildings were destroyed because 0.7 grams of uranium-235 were turned into pure energy. A dollar bill weighs more than that. The Trinity test had been kept secret, the bright flash in the desert dismissed by the War Department as an explosion at an ammunition dump. But the need for secrecy had passed, and publicity about the new weapon would send a clear message about America's military strength not only to Japan, but also to the Soviet Union. On August 6th, President Truman announced that an atomic bomb, harnessing the basic power of the universe, had just destroyed Hiroshima. "We are now prepared to obliterate more rapidly and completely every productive enterprise the Japanese have above ground in any city," Truman warned. "If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth." But the Japanese government still would not agree to an unconditional surrender, insisting that the emperor be allowed to remain on his throne. The day after Hiroshima's destruction, the governor of the local prefecture encouraged survivors to find an aroused fighting spirit to exterminate the devilish Americans. Meanwhile, another atomic bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was being assembled at a special building on Tinian. The floor of the building had been coated with rubber and lined with copper wire to minimize the chance that static electricity would cause a spark. The bomb was a Mark III implosion device, and putting it together presented more of a challenge than the assembly of Little Boy. Captain Parsons compared the effort to rebuilding an airplane in the field. Fat Man was scheduled for delivery on August 11th, with the city of Kokura as its target. The prospect of bad weather moved the date forward to the 9th. At around midnight the night before the bomb was to be loaded onto a silverplate B-29, a technician named Bernard J. O'Keefe noticed something wrong with the master firing cable that was supposed to connect the Archies to the X-Unit. The cable and the X-Unit both had female plugs. Somehow, the cable had been installed backward. It would take a couple of days to disassemble the layers of spheres and explosives, remove the cable, and reinstall it properly. "I felt a chill and started to sweat in the air-conditioned room," O'Keefe recalled. He decided to improvise. With help from another technician, he broke one major safety rule after another, propping the door open to bring in extension cords and using a soldering iron to attach the right plugs. It was risky to melt solder in a room with 5,000 pounds of explosives. The two men fixed the cable, connected the plugs, and didn't tell anyone what they'd done. The attempt to drop Fat Man on Kokura, the site of Japan's largest arsenal, did not go smoothly. After the bomb was loaded onto a B-29 called Boxcar, one of the plane's fuel pumps malfunctioned before takeoff. Major Charles W. Sweeney, the 25-year-old pilot commanding his first combat mission, decided to proceed with 600 gallons of fuel inaccessible in a reserve tank. 4 hours after leaving Tinian, flashing red lights on the flight test box suddenly indicated that the bomb's fuses had been activated. The red lights could mean the weapon was fully armed and ready to explode. Sweeney considered jettisoning the bomb over the ocean, but let Philip Barnes, the assistant weaponeer, tinker with the flight test box. Barnes quickly checked the blueprints, looked inside the box, and found that a couple of rotary switches had been set in the wrong position. The bomb wasn't armed, and the crew was relieved to hear it. Poor weather dogged the flight, with dark clouds and heavy turbulence. Boxcar circled for 40 minutes at a rendezvous point over Japan, wasting fuel, waiting for another American plane that never arrived. Sweeney opened the bomb bay doors over Kokura, but the city was shrouded in smoke and haze. He had strict orders to drop the bomb visually, not by radar. Boxcar spent almost an hour over Kokura, made 3 unsuccessful bombing runs, and drew anti-aircraft fire. The city was spared by the poor visibility. Sweeney had enough fuel for 1 run at the secondary target, Nagasaki. He dropped the bomb there, worried that the plane might have to be ditched in the ocean, and barely made it to the American airbase at Okinawa. Fat Man missed its aiming point by more than a mile. Instead of detonating above the Central Commercial District, the bomb went off above an industrial area on the western outskirts of Nagasaki. About 1/5 of the plutonium fissioned, and the force of the explosion was equal to about 21,000 tons of TNT, 21 kilotons. The bomb proved more powerful and efficient than the gun-type device used at Hiroshima, which had an explosive force of between 12 and 18 kilotons. But the damage was less severe in Nagasaki. A series of hills protected much of the city from the blast wave, and a firestorm never erupted, despite winds that reached more than 600 miles an hour. About 40,000 people were killed in Nagasaki, at least twice that number were injured, and more than 1/3 of the homes were destroyed. Ground Zero was approximately 500 feet south of the Mitsubishi Steelworks. According to one report, the plant was left bent and twisted like jelly. The bomb also leveled the nearby Mitsubishi Arms factory, where the torpedoes fired at Pearl Harbor were made. Most of the casualties in Hiroshima and Nagasaki resembled those caused by incendiaries and conventional bombs. About half of the victims burned to death, and about 1/3 were killed by debris. But 2 new types of casualty appeared. Flash burns were caused by the extraordinarily hot, though brief, detonation of the atomic bombs. Traveling in straight lines at the speed of light, the thermal radiation was strong enough to kill everyone within a mile of Ground Zero who was unprotected by walls or other objects that could block ultraviolet and infrared rays. Serious burns were possible at a distance of 2 miles. Thick clothing offered some protection because the flash lasted less than a second. White clothes tended to reflect thermal radiation, while darker colors absorbed it. A number of victims suffered flash burns that mimicked the dark and light patterns of their kimonos. The effects of ionizing radiation, primarily gamma rays emitted during the first minute after detonation, were even more disturbing. Perhaps 1/5 of the deaths at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were due to radiation sickness. People who'd survived the blast and the fires soon felt nauseated and tired. Some became ill within hours, while others seemed perfectly healthy for days before feeling unwell. Gamma rays had damaged the ability of their cells to replicate. The symptoms preceding their deaths were horrific: fever, vomiting, delirium, bloody diarrhea, internal bleeding, bleeding from the eyes and the mouth. For decades, some historians have questioned whether the use of atomic bombs was necessary. They have argued that Japan was already militarily defeated, that the blockade of Japanese ports had strangled the country's economy, that an American invasion would never have been required, that a conventional bombing campaign alone could have forced a surrender, that the Soviet Union's declaration of war on Japan had a greater impact than the atomic bombs, that a demonstration of one atomic bomb would have provided a sufficient shock to the Japanese psyche, that a promise the emperor could retain his throne would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. These counterfactual arguments, though compelling, can never be proved. But the historical facts remain. Hiroshima was destroyed on August 6th. 2 days later, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. Nagasaki was struck on the 9th, and the following day, General Koichika Anami, the Minister of War, still urged the Japanese people to fight, even though we have to eat grass and chew dirt and lay in the field. On August 14th, Emperor Hirohito overruled his generals and agreed to an unconditional surrender. "The enemy has for the first time used cruel bombs," he explained, "and the heavy casualties are beyond measure." Potential hazards. For a moment, Powell and Plum just stood there, stunned, looking down at the fuel pouring out of the missile and the white mist floating upward, reaching level 6, level 5, level 4. "Oh my God," Plum thought. "We've got to get the hell out of here." Powell radioed the control center. "There's some kind of white, milky substance in the air at level 7, he said. "And that's all," he said. Captain Mazzaro told the PTS team chief, Charles Heineman, that his men should leave the silo immediately. Heineman ordered them to evacuate and return to the blast block. Powell motioned to Plum, "Let's go." The missile was now shrouded in fuel vapor, and the cloud was approaching the platform where they stood. Mazzaro was puzzled. He wondered what this white substance could be. He thought about the maintenance that had been performed in the silo earlier in the day. What could the stuff be? He didn't want to notify the command post at Little Rock Air Force Base until he had a better idea of what was happening. Mazzaro asked Heineman, who was sitting nearby, if he could think of anything. The klaxon went off, and the fuel vapor launch duct light on the commander's console began flashing red. Powell and Plum left the silo and closed the door. Powell wanted to take the elevator down to a lower level, look at the base of the missile, and assess the damage. But the team chief ordered him and Plum to get out of the cableway and enter the blast block, where the backup team was stationed. Roger Hamm and Gregory Lester opened blast door 9 for them, let them in, and then Lester quickly pulled it shut. They popped the helmets off their Refcos as Hamm locked the door. Powell threw the wrench handle onto the floor and cursed. Mazzaro turned off the klaxon. The fuel vapor launch duct light made no sense. Why would that come on when the PTS crew was pressurizing the Stage 2 oxidizer tank? He asked for vapor readings from the mine safety appliance, which were displayed on a panel in the blast block. 3 old-fashioned gauges there showed the vapor levels in the silo. Needles on the gauges moved to the right as the amount of vapor increased. The PTS team reported that the oxidizer level was 10 parts per million, and the fuel vapor level was 40 parts per million, almost the maximum reading. One of those gauges had to be wrong. There couldn't be fuel vapors and oxidizer vapors in the silo at the same time. The two would have mixed and caused an explosion. Mazzaro wondered which gauge was correct. Then the needle on the fuel vapor gauge surged all the way to the right, and the MSA spiked. The klaxon went off again, and Al Childers looked up. He'd ignored it the first time, but now realized that something was wrong. He was sitting at a table behind the commander's console, filling out paperwork that recommended his student, Miguel Serrano, for another alert. Suddenly, the console was lit up like a Christmas tree. Rows of warning lights were flashing red. Then Childers heard somebody say there was a fire in the hall, got up from the table, grabbed a copy of the Dash 1, searched the manual for the fire checklist, found it, and started going through each step. Now the spray lights were lit, which meant that the fire suppression system had been automatically triggered. Thousands of gallons of water were pouring into the launch duct. Childers pushed the surface warning control button, turning on the red beacon topside, and contacted the PTS team up there. Eric Ayala was in his Refco suit, standing near the nitrogen tank on the hard stand, when he heard over the radio that Powell and Plum were backing out of the silo. Then he heard fire in the hall and Childers ordering everyone topside to evacuate the site. Ayala and his partner, Richard Willinghurst, quickly took off their Refcos. The third member of the team, David Adderhold, was sitting in a truck parked near the access portal, monitoring the radio. The truck held four extra Refcos, air packs, Dewar units to refill them with air, and a portable shower. After hearing the order to evacuate, he helped Ayala and Willinghurst pack up their suits. Everyone jumped into the truck, leaving an empty pickup behind, and then Willinghurst drove toward the gate. A white cloud floated from the silo exhaust shaft, like smoke rising from a chimney. Childers called the command post and said there was a fire in the silo. Mazzaro was already on the phone with Little Rock. Holder came down the stairs, noticed the commotion, and sat at the commander's console. The warning lights didn't make sense. Fuel vapor launch duct, oxy vapor launch duct, fire launch duct. One of those might be correct, but not all three at the same time. Holder decided to go through the checklists for a fuel leak, an oxidizer leak, a fire. One of the first steps for any propellant leak was to check the propellant tank pressure monitor unit, PTPMU, the digital readout on top of the console. It displayed the pressure levels in each of the missile's four tanks. Holder pushed the buttons on the PTPMU and recorded the numbers in his logbook. For some reason, the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank seemed low. It was 6:40 in the evening, about 10 minutes after the first klaxon had sounded. Ronald Fuller was going through all three checklists, too. He closed the blast valve, sealing the ventilation system, cutting off the control center from the air outdoors, and began to set up a portable vapor detector near blast door 8. It would warn if toxic fumes were seeping into the room. The gate phone rang, and Childers answered it. The PTS crew topside wanted to leave the complex. Childers opened the gate for them and then returned to the fuel vapor checklist. He couldn't understand why the purge fan in the silo wouldn't go on. The purge fan was supposed to clear out any fuel vapors. He kept pushing the purge button, but nothing happened. Then he remembered that if there was a fire, they didn't want the fan to go on. It would pull fresh air into the silo and feed the fire. "Can my people come back into the control center?" Heinemann asked. Childers said yes. He'd thought it was useful to keep Powell, Plum, and the others in the blast lock, monitoring the vapor levels on the panel. But then he remembered that the MSA automatically shut off whenever the sprays went on, so that water wouldn't be sucked into the vapor sensors. Too many things seemed to be happening at once. It felt hard to stay on top of them all. Powell and Plum entered the control center in their Refcos, Ham and Lester in thermal underwear. In the rush to get out of the blast lock, the two had left their Refcos in boxes on the floor there. Blast door 8 was swiftly closed and locked. Heinemann joined his men, and the group huddled near the door. "There's got to be a malfunction," Childers said 3 or 4 times. Too many warning lights were flashing at once. But even if it was a malfunction, the crew had to act as though the hazards were real. Childers asked Serrano if he'd ever plotted a toxic corridor on a map. Serrano replied that he'd once taken a class on it. "Well, get over here," Childers said. "You're going to watch me do it." With a map, a compass, a grease pencil, and a protractor, Childers started to plot on a map where a cloud of fuel, smoke, or oxidizer would travel outdoors. The wind speed was almost zero, good news for the nearby houses and farms, but not for the crew. A toxic cloud would hover and swirl directly above the missile complex. Captain Mazzaro was still on the phone to the command post, where a missile potential hazard team was being formed. At the direction of the wing commander, the officers and airmen on the base who knew the most about the Titan II were being recalled to duty. Maintenance and operations supervisors, the chief of safety, the chief of missile engineers, an electrical engineer, a bioenvironmental engineer, a backup missile combat crew, among others. Security police were calling homes and searching classrooms to gather the team, and a missile potential hazard net was being established, a conference call linking the command post at Little Rock with experts at SAC headquarters in Omaha, the Ogden Air Logistics Center at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, and the headquarters of the 8th Air Force at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. One of the command post's first decisions was to send a missile alarm response team, MART, to the launch complex. A pair of security officers stationed at a nearby missile site grabbed their gas masks and hurried to Damascus. While Fuller was setting up the portable vapor detector near the blast door, he overheard one of the PTS crew say something about a dropped socket. Fuller asked what had happened in the silo. After hearing the story, Fuller said they needed to tell the commander. Powell stepped forward, admitted to dropping the socket, and began to cry. He described how it fell and hit the thrust mount, how fuel sprayed from the missile like water from a hose. When he was done, the room fell silent. Holy shit, thought Holder. Captain Mazzaro told Powell to come over to the phone and tell the command post exactly what had happened. Powell got on the line and repeated the story. The details were incredible, but plausible. Things fell all the time in the silo. Nuts, bolts, screwdrivers, flashlights, all sorts of tools. They always fell harmlessly into the W at the bottom of the silo, and then someone had to climb down and get them. You could drop a socket 1,000 times from a platform at level 2 without its ever bouncing off the thrust mount and hitting the missile. And even if it did hit the missile, it would probably cause a dent and nothing more, and nobody would ever know. Half an hour after the accident, everyone realized what they were dealing with: a major fuel leak. Maybe a fire. The Dash One didn't have a checklist for this scenario. Now it was time to improvise, to figure out what could be done to save the missile and the warhead and the 10 men in the underground control center. Sid King was having dinner at a friend's house when he got a call from the board operator at KGFL, the AM radio station in Clinton, Arkansas. "It sounds like there's something going on at the Titan II silo in Damascus," the operator said. "A leak or something." King was the manager and part owner of KGFL, as well as its roving reporter. His friend Tom Phillips was the station's sales rep. Clinton was about 17 miles north of Damascus along Highway 65, and Choctaw, where Phillips lived, was even closer to the missile site. "Let's run down there and check it out," King suggested. Phillips thought that sounded like a good idea. They said goodbye to their wives and got into KGFL's mobile unit, a Dodge Omni that King had fitted with a VHF transmitter and a big antenna. The nickname of the subcompact, the Live Ear, was painted on both sides, along with the station's call letters. King was 27 years old. He'd been raised in Providence, a town with a population of approximately 100, about an hour east of Damascus. His father was a jack-of-all-trades, a math teacher who also sold real estate, cut hair, and managed a movie theater to support the family and their small farm. King had an idyllic small-town childhood, but also dreamed of someday leaving rural Arkansas for Hollywood. At Arkansas State University, he studied radio and television, encouraged by a great uncle who'd been one of the first TV weathermen in Arkansas. During the summers, King was the drummer of the house band at Dog Patch USA, an amusement park in the Ozarks featuring Lil Abner and other characters created by the cartoonist Al Capp. The house band played for hours every night, mainly Dixieland jazz, soft rock like Joy to the World, and show tunes like Sunrise, Sunset from Fiddler on the Roof. Working at Dog Patch was a lot of fun, and King got a full-time job there after college. He fell for Judy Clark, a tap dancer at the park, and the two soon got married. Backed by a brother-in-law, King started looking for a good place in Arkansas to open a new radio station. Clinton, they decided, was the place. It was the county seat of Van Buren County in the foothills of the Ozarks, with a population of about 1,600 and a downtown that attracted shoppers from throughout the area. In 1977, KGFL went on the air as a 250-watt sunset station, licensed to broadcast only during daylight hours. King wanted the station to assume the role that a small-town newspaper would have played a generation earlier. KGFL started each day with the national anthem. It played gospel music for about half an hour, then switched to country and western. During the morning, it broadcast phone-in shows like Trading Post, a radio flea market that allowed local callers to buy and sell things. In the afternoon, when kids got out of school, the station began to play rock and roll, and that's what it played until going off the air at dusk. King's wife opened a dance studio near the station, teaching jazz, tap, and ballet to children. Her studio was on the second floor of the only two-story building in downtown Clinton. Sid King and Tom Phillips were about the same age. They'd met at Dog Patch, where Phillips had played Lil Abner, and they were already familiar with the Titan II site in Damascus. KGFL had covered an accident there a couple of years earlier. At about 3 in the morning on January 27, 1978, an oxidizer trailer parked on the hard stand had started to leak. The trailer was heated to ensure that the oxidizer remained above 42 degrees during the winter, but the thermostat was broken. Instead of keeping the oxidizer at about 60 degrees, the heater pushed it to more than 100 degrees, far beyond its boiling point. A brown plume of oxidizer floated from the trailer, eventually becoming a cloud half a mile long and 100 yards wide. The crew in the underground control center had no idea that the trailer topside was leaking oxidizer. The leak was discovered about 5 hours later by the missile crew arriving at the site to pull an alert that morning. The crew spotted the cloud of oxidizer from the road, turned around, drove back to Damascus, and called the command post from a payphone. A PTS team with REFCO suits was flown by helicopter to launch Complex 374-7. They fixed the leak and lowered the temperature of the oxidizer by spraying the trailer with cold water for hours. The missile site's neighbors were not pleased by the incident. A cloud of oxidizer had drifted across nearby farms, killing more than a dozen cattle, sickening a farmer who'd gotten up early to milk his cows, and forcing the evacuation of a local elementary school. The farmer later filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the Air Force and the companies that made the trailer. Gus Anglin, the sheriff of Van Buren County, was standing with a state trooper on the shoulder of Highway 65 near the access road to the silo when King and Phillips rolled up in the live ear. Anglin was in his early 40s, thin and wiry, the sort of rural sheriff who knew the names of all the teenagers in town, knew their parents, and knew the right threat to make kids slow down, go home, or stop doing what they were just doing. Van Buren County didn't have much crime, aside from petty theft, some pot growing, and the occasional domestic dispute. And yet Anglin still found himself constantly answering the phone in the middle of the night and leaving his house to deal with all kinds of unexpected things. He wore a badge and drove a squad car, but didn't carry a gun, unless the situation seemed to demand one. He and a couple of deputies had to cover thousands of square miles in the county, which took him away from his wife and two children for long stretches of time. Anglin felt obligated to answer every call personally, from the minor ones to the most urgent. That was what the Van Buren County Sheriff was supposed to do, a lesson learned from his father-in-law, who'd previously held the job and hired him to serve as a deputy. During the early morning leak in 1978, Anglin had evacuated Damascus residents who lived in the path of the oxidizer. The experience had left him frustrated with the Air Force. At first, the Air Force didn't know what was happening, and then it didn't want to tell him. Again and again, he was assured that the reddish-brown cloud posed no serious threat. He and one of his deputies inhaled a fair amount of oxidizer while escorting people out of their homes. It made both of them sick. After Anglin got the dry heaves and vomited in the road, the two were airlifted by helicopter to the hospital at Little Rock Air Force Base. They were given a clean bill of health and released within a few hours. But Anglin got headaches and didn't feel right for weeks. Now a column of what looked like white smoke rose into the sky from the same missile complex. Once again, nobody from the Air Force had bothered to give him a call. King said hello to the sheriff and the state trooper. "Let's go down there and see what's going on," Anglin suggested. The four men walked down the access road, wondering what was wrong this time, as the evening light grew dim. They reached the perimeter fence and stopped for a second. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, a couple of Air Force security officers appeared with M16 rifles and asked what they were doing there. "I'm the sheriff of the county," Anglin said, "and it looks like you've got another problem. We're just trying to figure out what we need to do. Do we need to evacuate people?" "No, no. We've got everything under control," one of the security officers replied. The command post at Little Rock was on top of the situation. Anglin and the state trooper turned around and started walking back toward the highway. The sheriff did not look pleased. King started firing questions at the security officers. "What exactly is the problem? Is that smoke? Is there a fire?" One of the officers was about to answer, then asked King and Phillips if they worked for the sheriff's department. When King said, "No, we're with KGFL, the officer's response was blunt. "Sir, get your ass out of here." The two young men laughed as they returned to their car. "Boy, he wasn't in too good a mood," Phillips said. They decided to stick around for a while alongside the highway and see what happened next. But first, they had to get a message to the station. The transmitter on the Omni wasn't strong enough to send a signal over the nearby hill on Highway 65, so they drove to the top of it. King asked the technician at the station to contact the Associated Press and KATV, the ABC affiliate in Little Rock. "Tell them something's wrong at the Titan II complex in Damascus," King said. Then they drove down the hill, parked near the access road, and waited. Childers and Holder took turns at the console where the commander normally sat. Mazzaro stood at the other console or paced back and forth in the room. He was one of the finest missile combat crew commanders that either of them had met, but now he seemed distracted. Every few minutes, one of them would push the hazard alert logic reset button. It was supposed to turn off any warning lights that were malfunctioning, that were signaling a non-existent problem. Not long after Powell admitted to having dropped the socket, the reset button was pushed, and the oxy-vapor launch duct light went out. That confirmed what Childers and Holder already suspected. There was no oxidizer leak. At least one potential hazard could be ruled out. They knew that the Stage 1 fuel tank was leaking and that fuel vapors were filling the silo. But was there really a fire? Holder thought that once the tank was pierced, fuel vapors began to interact with the oxidized aluminum panels in the silo. He didn't think there was a roaring fire. It was more likely a smoldering one, hot enough to set off the fire detectors. The PTS crew topside had given conflicting accounts of the cloud leaving the exhaust vent, at first describing it as white, later as green smoke. Childers thought there was a fuel leak, pure and simple, that had somehow registered as a fire. Fuel vapors were easily mistaken for smoke. He couldn't explain, however, why the fire detectors had been triggered. They were mechanical devices containing a sliver of metal that melted at 140 degrees. They should be reliable. Perhaps the hazard warning circuitry had malfunctioned, signaling that the detectors had been triggered when they hadn't. In any event, the sprays in the silo would help. Water would dilute the fuel, making it less flammable and explosive. And if there was a smoldering fire, the water would extinguish it. A new set of problems soon emerged. Every 5 minutes, Holder had been recording the Stage 1 tank pressures from the PTPMU. The ideal pressure for both the fuel and the oxidizer tanks was 11.5 pounds per square inch, PSI. About half an hour after the accident, the fuel pressure had dropped to 5.5, while the oxidizer pressure had risen to 18.6. The combination of water and fuel in the silo created heat, increasing the pressure in the oxidizer tank. If the pressure became too great, the tank would rupture and the oxidizer would pour out. It would mix with the fuel in the silo, causing an explosion. Meanwhile, the leak was lowering the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank. The small hole allowed fuel to leave the tank but didn't let air enter it. The Stage 1 fuel tank sat at the bottom of the missile and supported much of its weight. The Titan II's aluminum skin was about the width of a nickel. In much the same way that a car is supported by the air in its tires, not the rubber, the huge missile was bolstered by the 85,000 pounds of rocket fuel in its Stage 1 tank. That tank wasn't supposed to be empty when the others were full, unless the missile was flying hundreds of miles off the ground. If the fuel tank on the bottom collapsed, the oxidizer tank directly above it would tumble and burst. The two propellants would mix, and the missile would explode. The pressure levels in both of the Stage 1 tanks were now moving in opposite directions. One was rising due to the heat, the other was falling due to the leak. The oxidizer tank was likely to rupture when its pressure rose to about 25 or 30 PSI. And the fuel tank was likely to collapse when its pressure fell to somewhere between -2 and -3 PSI. At 7:30, about an hour after the accident, the pressure in the fuel tank